I'm going to be announcing exactly right now that I'm going to be putting our Vice President Mike Pence in charge. And Mike will be working with the professionals, doctors, and everybody else that's working. The team is brilliant. I spent a lot of time with the team over the last couple of weeks, but they're totally brilliant. And we're doing really well. And Mike is going to be in charge, and Mike will report back to me. But he's got a certain talent for this.
President Trump attempting to calm fears yesterday by downplaying the severity of COVID-19, the new coronavirus that's spreading. We'll talk more about the U.S. response and Pence's record handling other outbreaks later in the show. First, though, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is leading the delegate race in the Democratic presidential primary, and that's making the Democratic Party establishment pretty nervous about whether he can beat Donald Trump and cost House Democrats their majority. Joining me now to talk about this is Mike DeBonis. He covers the House for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So Speaker Pelosi says she wants Democrats to rally behind the eventual nominee. She has said unity, unity, unity. But privately, some of her closest allies are really scared that that nominee will be Sanders. Why are they so scared?
Well, there's a pretty dramatic disconnect from the type of agenda that Bernie Sanders is running on and the type of agenda that the majority of the Democratic House Democratic Caucus ran on and won on, particularly in 2018 when they won the majority. So they're just afraid that voters are who were on board for fairly modest agenda items like lowering prescription drug prices and, addressing climate change are not on board for more aggressive measures like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, and that that's going to keep them from voting for Democratic congressional candidates in November.
So what are those Democratic congressional candidates doing, if anything? Are they trying to campaign on a totally different platform, trying to say, hey, we're not Bernie, we're not with him on this?
They're already starting to do that right now. They're mostly fretting about it. They're looking, talking to each other, wondering what can we do if Bernie Sanders is the nominee. I think that there's starting to be some effort in the Democratic Party institutions to sort of figure out a way to differentiate these down ballot candidates from the rest of the ticket. But it's very early in that stage. And people are, still holding out hope that something will happen where Bernie Sanders' march to the nomination will be arrested. But right now, the anxiety level is high among this group of Democrats. And, they're looking for some, some solution that will allow them to separate themselves from the top of the ticket.
Mm. And are the fears justified when you look at history? Because when you look at what Sanders has been able to do, he's been the top vote getter in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada. He's energized young voters in a way the other candidates simply have not. So are the fears justified?
That's a great question. And I think, most of the smarter people I talk to approach this with a good deal of humility in saying, like, look, we thought things were going to go a certain way in 2016. We thought Donald Trump was going to be a disaster in swing states, that, he was going to take down the entire Republican House majority with him. That didn't happen. Obviously, Donald Trump is president. Democrats picked up a handful of seats in 2016, but they didn't come anywhere near close to taking the majority back. And there's a lot of voices in the party, not only on the left, who say, listen, if this is the people's choice, if this is a candidate in Bernie Sanders who can actually inspire people to come out and cast their votes, that's not something to be feared, that would be a good result for Democrats. And that's, that's part of the conversation that's taking place right now. And it's part of why Nancy Pelosi is staying above it all, above the fray, preaching unity and saying and not trying to put her thumb on the scale one way or the other.
Right. But she did say or she declined to say whether a candidate who wins just a plurality of pledged delegates should get the nomination. So that's a key term, right? The plurality of pledged delegates.
Right. I mean, the rules as they are written, you need a majority plus one to win the nomination, and that those rules aren't going to change. I think that what Nancy Pelosi was doing there was just sort of acknowledging reality, which is you know, the eventual nominee is going to have to get a majority. What's happened in the past is that, you know, members who had won only a plurality of the votes as the primary process continues is that, you know, candidates drop out, candidates throw their support to other candidates, and there's sort of a coalescing that happens before you even get to the convention. And that certainly is in question right now. But I think it's pretty early, and I don't think Nancy Pelosi was signaling her, you know, that she wants a contested convention or anything like that. I think she was just trying to nod towards what the rules are.
And the rules have changed, right, since 2016?
They have. Most notably, the role of so-called superdelegates, who are sort of party officials who basically can cast their votes independent of any primary or caucus vote. Their role has been reduced. They don't get to cast ballot. They don't get to cast their votes on a first ballot. There are fewer of them, and they now have to wait for a later stage in a nomination fight. But they're still out there, and a lot of them do fear a Bernie Sanders nomination. And, you know, it's certainly a group of people that are going to be watched closely in the next weeks and months.
Right. Well, so let's say that Bernie Sanders does get a majority plus one, but he doesn't reach the 1991 threshold for the nomination. That's when the superdelegates would come into play. And is there some serious talk now of those superdelegates denying him the eventual nomination?
Serious talk is kind of a subjective, you know, criteria. You know, we're at an early stage of this. There's a lot of people who have strong feelings who don't think Bernie Sanders would be, the best nominee. But like, listen, we've got, you know, literally millions of people who are yet to vote. You know, as voters continue to make their voices heard in these primaries, you know, South Carolina on Saturday, Super Tuesday. We've got a big chunk of states on the 10th and the 17th. I think the picture will start to emerge a little more, and some of these party, officials are going to be hard-pressed to say, well, a candidate who has 35, 40, 45% of the vote, we can just sweep them aside and find somebody else. I think that the pressure is going to mount. That's what happened in 2016 with Donald Trump. I mean, it's happened before, and a lot of the sort of speculation right now is sort of caught in this moment rather than the moment where this, you know, discussion is actually going to be taking place months down the road.
Right. So it's a little premature is what you're saying.
Yeah. And clearly, I mean, absolutely, there's party officials out there who were freaking out, for lack of a better term. But, the idea that there's going to be some sort of hijacking of the nomination right now is in the realm of, you know, speculation, informed speculation. But it's, you know, there hasn't been a serious organized effort to do that as of yet. And it'll be harder to do that if Sanders solidifies his standing as the front runner going forward.
Mike DeBonis covers the House for The Washington Post. Thanks, Mike.
My pleasure.
Coming up, your questions on the coronavirus answered next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, as the coronavirus continues to spread across the globe, so too is the fear of it becoming a pandemic. Earlier today, Japan says it's closing all its schools through March. Several new countries, including Brazil, Greece, and Georgia, have reported cases in the last 24 hours. And yesterday, the CDC confirmed a woman in Northern California has the disease. She had no recent travel history and had not come in close contact with anyone known to have the virus. So that's a bit of a mystery there. Now, dozens of people at UC Davis Medical Center, where the woman was treated, are being monitored. We asked you, our listeners, for your questions on the new coronavirus. It's called COVID-19. And joining us to answer them and to talk about the case in Northern California is Dr. Michael Wilkes. He is a doctor at UC Davis Health, where the infected woman is being treated, and also happens to be a KCRW contributor. Hello there.
Hey, Madeline. Good day. It's been a crazy journey the past few weeks, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. So what's happening there at UC Davis? How is this woman being treated?
Well, she's, I think, critically sick, and she's being treated aggressively. Perhaps the reason this has attracted so much attention is that we've tested about 445 people in the whole United States over the past couple of weeks. We've got 12 of those people who've been identified who have travel-related COVID-19, and then only two people who have what we're assuming is person-to-person contact, and this particular person didn't have any known contacts. So it's a mystery, and you know, perhaps to listeners, it increases the anxiety and fear factor.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, there are reports that she had to wait several days to be tested by the CDC. Why the delay?
Yeah, I'm not sure that anybody's been able to answer that clearly for me. You know, I think that CDC is overwhelmed. Listeners will know, as regular NPR listeners, that about a year ago or so, the CDC fired all of their pandemic team. So they were sort of firing on less than a full bank of cylinders. Then they've run into some difficulties with the tests. The hope was that major health departments like California's health department would be able to do these tests. That didn't work out quite so well. There was a glitch with the test kits, and now they've got about 12 sites that are up and running. But interestingly, none of them are in the state of California, so that what has to happen is once somebody suspects someone might be infected, there are two kinds of swabs, and then they have to be sent to Atlanta to be tested. And so, you know, it takes a day for them to get to Atlanta. And then, you know, the CDC has set up a separate new lab. So they now have two functioning labs. But, you know, just by comparison, we've tested 445 total COVID-19s. And in South Korea, in an equal amount of time, I think the numbers are close to 40,000 tests they've done. So we're way behind.
Yeah, I don't understand that. Why can't they set up local testing centers?
Well, I think it's not so much that they can't set up the centers. It's that the actual tests themselves have been, you know, there's been a glitch in the medium, and they just haven't been able to get to the health departments. The health departments in California, for example, do all kinds of sophisticated testing. This is not an issue of quality or human resources in the state. It really has to do with the reagents and getting them, you know, and doing the kinds of quality control so that if somebody comes back positive, we know they're really positive, or if they come back negative, we can bank on the fact that, you know, at that moment they were negative.
What are the symptoms of this disease, and how should you, if you have a cough or a fever, should you suspect that you might have it?
The problem is that there are no what we call pathognomonic or unique symptoms for this particular virus. They are identical to a bad cold, or even more closely identical to the influenza virus. So that makes it really hard to identify. And we're seeing, you know, tens of thousands of cases of influenza. We're in the middle of you know, America's flu season. You know, we're seeing 14 cases of COVID.
Which brings us to our listener questions. And I want to ask you one that one of our listeners, Jonathan, has posed. He says, the CDC says 280,000 people have been infected with influenza. 16,000 have died. These numbers are nowhere near coronavirus, what you just said. So why is all the focus on coronavirus? Does it distract from the flu, which vulnerable people should be more concerned about?
Well, so Jonathan is dead on. The numbers he's quoting are exactly accurate, and his point is very well taken. This coronavirus, as I'd mentioned, is in its infancy. We know very little about it, and perhaps that's what's making it so mysterious and so scary. We do know that this is a relatively mild year for influenza deaths, 16,000. If that ends up being the total number of deaths for the year, is about half or even a third of what happens in a bad year in the United States. Influenza deserves a lot more attention, but there's something we can do for influenza. You know, people, if they haven't gotten immunized, should get immunized. It looks like the immunization this year is pretty effective. But for COVID, there's nothing. There is no immunization. There's no medication. All there is are these sort of three areas of what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions.
So those are basically rest, fluids, and isolation?
Well, no, those are what you would do if you felt you had the infection, and those are you're right on there, Madeline. But no, in terms of non-pharmaceutical interventions, at least from a public health perspective, we've got sort of personal measures that you can take, and that's that you're at least 3 to 4 feet away from people that could be infected and washing surfaces. The second category are community-based interventions, and those are things like social distancing. You talked about Japan closing schools and, you know, not going to basketball games and staying away from, you know, airports and train stations and things like that. And then the third category are what we call environmental non-pharmaceutical interventions. And those have to do with cleaning surfaces and making sure that the environment is as, clean as it can possibly be.
Okay, another listener asks, this listener is Kay. She asks, or he, just K, the letter, is it airborne? Can it survive on surfaces without a host, and for how long?
So a great question. If it is airborne, it causes a lot more concern. And if it can survive on inanimate objects, that also raises the concern. And so for K, my response is, with caution, it does look like it is airborne, but for very short periods of time. It doesn't circulate. It's a fairly big particle. So, you know, once it gets coughed out, you can get it, but it will quickly fall to the ground or other surfaces, which leads to the next part of Kay's question. It does look like it can survive on surfaces, not for huge amounts of time, but certainly for double-digit numbers of minutes, maybe even, you know, triple-digit numbers of minutes, 100 or 200 minutes or so. So, you know, you want to be careful to wash your hands, to not touch your face, and more data will be coming in.
Right. And another listener asks, why is no one else but China spraying and disinfecting streets and building exteriors? In fact, L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti says LAX is being disinfected every hour. Would that be helpful in trying to prevent the spread of this?
Madeline, I don't know. There's certainly no evidence that what's going on in China with regard to disinfecting streets and spraying buildings and things makes any sense or any difference. But that is to say that there's no evidence that it doesn't. There's just no evidence.
Okay, well, speaking of travel, the State Department has deemed China and South Korea a level 3, which means avoid all non-essential travel. Japan, Italy, and Iran a level 2, which means people should reconsider travel plans. Should they? Let's say you're planning a trip in the next few months to those countries. Should you cancel?
Well, I think it depends on your risk adversity. I think that someone who is totally risk adverse is going to be much safer staying at home. As I mentioned, you know, the places where travelers frequent, airports, train stations, and the like, are places where there are lots of people, and perhaps the risk is higher than listeners who just stay at home. You know, we do have Easter coming up, and lots of folks will travel, some locally and some distance. I guess if a patient of mine came in and said that they were going to Italy, for Easter, I would sort of suggest that if they, were concerned that they not do that this Easter and perhaps postpone and go, you know, Memorial Day or July 4th or something when they have a break. Again, no one knows how this is going to evolve. I'm just giving you my best guess. You know, if it was a family member, I certainly would tell them for any of the countries that you just mentioned, it would make sense, I think, to hold off.
And especially if people have compromised immune systems?
Yeah, there are a bunch of high-risk groups, but certainly anybody who's got compromised immune systems, and I probably would throw into that category people with diabetes, certainly older people over the age of 65, people with respiratory preconditions, things like asthma and emphysema should think twice, and then people with very young persons who they're responsible for, infants, also might want to think about rescheduling.
Hmm. And I guess locally, people might be worried about going to crowded places, you know, concerts or sporting events, things like that.
Mm, right. Right. Again, you know, I wish I could offer listeners some evidence-based suggestions here. You know, I think it makes sense that the more you're with crowds, the higher the risk of getting any infectious disease. That would include, you know, influenza or a cold, but it also would include COVID-19. But I also need to remind everybody that we are talking here about a total of two people in the entire United States who've gotten this from person to person. The other 12 were folks from the Diamond Princess who had travel-related known exposures. So we're talking about two people out of 300 million people in the United States who, you know, as best we know, have been tested and are positive. So, you know, I don't know if I had bought tickets to a major event that I'd been waiting a year to, and it was, you know, today or this weekend, I would probably go. You know, we'll have to see how things evolve in the days and weeks to come. But, you know, I wish I could offer some better advice than that.
All right, Dr. Michael Wilkes, he is at UC Davis Health, and he's also a KCRW contributor. Thank you.
My pleasure, Madeline. Nice talking to you.
And Governor Gavin Newsom today says there are 28 people in California with the disease. The state is monitoring around 8,400 others. He says the state of California is now at a turning point. Well, yesterday, President Trump put Vice President Mike Pence in charge of the U.S. response to the coronavirus.
As a former governor from the state where the first MERS case emerged in 2014, I know full well the importance of presidential leadership, the importance of administration leadership, and the vital role of partnerships of state and local governments and health authorities in responding to the potential threat of dangerous infectious diseases.
But Pence's response to a 2015 HIV outbreak in Indiana is drawing scrutiny. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today she spoke with Pence and raised concerns about his ability to handle a public health crisis.
So this is about resources. It's also about personnel. It's also about respect for science, for evidence-based decision-making.
We're going to examine Pence's record now with Laura Unger. She is the Midwest editor and correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she covered the 2015 HIV outbreak in Indiana extensively. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, remind us of the details of this outbreak. What happened?
So back in February of 2015, the state first announced that they were seeing 26 confirmed cases of HIV in an area that previously had about 3 in a decade. So what was happening was this area had high levels of addiction, and a lot of folks were shooting up Opana, which is a painkiller, and sharing needles. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it was spreading very widely.
And Pence was governor at the time. What was his response?
So at the time, there was a ban on syringe exchanges, and he supported that ban. So from the time that the outbreak was announced, it took 29 days before he signed an executive order allowing a limited syringe exchange in the Scott County area. So, and by that time, the number of confirmed cases had risen to 79, so it more than tripled.
Wow.
In the delay.
So just in that month of delay?
Yes.
And what was his reason for not backing a syringe exchange if that was what could have prevented the spread of HIV?
Well, he was against syringe exchanges. Many people were against them at the time, and many people remain against them because they believe that they may encourage or enable drug use. But actually, science has shown that they do not, and in fact, they connect people with services like treatment. They do not increase crime. So the science does not show that, but there are definitely opponents who believe that syringe exchanges enable drug use.
And so why did he change his mind and then go ahead and allow the syringe exchange?
So he was being pressed by a lot of people at the time. So local health leaders and the CDC at the time were trying to encourage the ban to be lifted. And actually, I did a series of stories looking at the town's only doctor, William Cook. And he actually was in a meeting with other Scott County health officials at the time, right before Pence signed his executive order. And in that meeting, they talked about responding. And then afterwards, Dr. Cook encouraged him to do everything needed, including a syringe exchange. And Pence responded to him that he would need to pray on it.
He would need to pray on it.
Yes. Yes.
Does that raise some concern? We heard Speaker Pelosi say that she wanted to make sure that his response to the coronavirus would be evidence-based. Is there any fear that his response to this current disease will not be evidence-based?
Yes, there are fears about that. The science definitely backs up syringe exchanges being a good preventative tool, and it took a while for him to come around on those. But in general, with any sort of outbreak like this, or really any public health crisis, the two most important things are prevention and quick action. And you can certainly say that those lessons were learned in Austin, Indiana, where both of them were lacking. Certainly, prevention was not robust, and the action was delayed. So there are lessons to be learned that really could be put into place for the coronavirus outbreak, as well as really any kind of public health crisis.
So when you look at everything that you're talking about HIV, but can you extend what you've learned and what you've observed in terms of preparedness to fight this outbreak, HIV? Can you apply some of these lessons to what we're seeing now in terms of the federal response to coronavirus?
I think you can, because prevention is key in any situation, and prevention is an issue now as it was then, just as far as having a robust health system, having the funding in place to be able to respond when something arises. Many health departments, especially in rural areas, are very low on staff. So those kinds of issues come into play. Also, quick action, being able to quickly mobilize and not delay when there's the first sign of a problem. That also is something that is true, whether it's HIV or coronavirus or the flu or anything else. So those two lessons are just paramount, and that's a lesson that anyone can take away from what happened in Austin to prevent a similar tragedy.
Laura Unger from Kaiser Health News, thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, we profile Rachel Rossi, the public defender running to be the next LA County DA. She's backed by a group representing alleged victims of Democratic donor Ed Buck.
The Ed Buck prosecution, I think, is maybe something that she sees as a potential liability for Jackie Lacey.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Next Tuesday, voters will decide who will be LA County's district attorney, overseeing the largest prosecutorial office in the country. Jackie Lacey is the current DA. She's facing two challengers from her left. One of them is Rachel Rossi, who's never been a prosecutor. She's a former public defender. Rossi says understanding how that side of the legal system works is key to fixing the whole thing.
We've now started to see a prosecutor that functions as an adversary of the defense and who only seeks conviction and the most amount of time possible. We need a prosecutor who seeks justice. And sometimes justice means incarceration. Sometimes justice means humanity, treatment, programs, therapy, services.
Joining us to tell us more about Rachel Rossi and her background is LA Magazine's Brittany Martin. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what do we know about her record as a public defender?
She served in the office for 3 years in the county level and then another 4 as an assistant federal public defender. During that time, saw that there were a lot of cases that were coming through her office that were primarily people of color, people struggling with poverty. She perceived it as an injustice, and that really informed her worldview, and it informs a lot of what she goes on to do with her career in terms of criminal justice reform.
And she worked with Senator Dick Durbin when she was in Washington and helped with criminal justice reform. What did she do there?
She worked as the lead staffer on a piece of legislation called the First Step Act. It has a bunch of different provisions, but one of them is how female inmates are given hygiene supplies or if women can be held in certain kinds of restraints while pregnant. But it also contains mandates on de-escalation training for correction officers. And it also provides for certain inmates to serve shorter prison sentences if they meet particular kinds of requirements, take certain kinds of training that make it more possible for them to re-enter the civilian population.
What does she say to criticism from Jackie Lacey and others that this is a job for a prosecutor, not a public defender, that basically you're prosecuting alleged crimes? And does she have the experience or the wherewithal to do that?
I think that her campaign would say that what she did outside of prosecuting maybe informs that. That's certainly been a key point of her campaign. She is the first former public defender to run for DA in Los Angeles County, but she's not the first one to do it at all. In fact, the person who is now the DA in San Francisco, he took over the seat that used to be George Gascon's. That's one of the people that she's primarily running against now.
Right. So I guess it's a mini trend that public defenders are now prosecutors or DAs?
It's a little trend that they're running. It's not necessarily always a trend that they're winning. Boudin is kind of an outlier. Tiffany Caban, former public defender, ran in New York last year, did not win. And she had a campaign pretty similar to Rossi's.
And speaking of the idea of a public defender being on the ballot, there was a little bit of a dust-up when George Gascon objected to that being on the ballot, she being described as a former public defender. Can you talk about that? What happened?
Officially speaking, the complaint was that it would mislead voters because that's not her current role, and she had had other jobs since then. But it seems the kind of takeaway in the chattering classes has been that being a public defender is seen as a desirable label to put on yourself in this race.
Hmm. Well, is that the case? Are voters swayed by that?
We don't really know yet, since this is the first time it will have ever happened in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It definitely appears that she and George Gascon are maybe fighting for the same pool of voters, and Jackie Lacey is maybe running in a more moderate lane. And it remains to be seen if they'll make that 50% plus one needed to avoid a runoff.
What are her major campaign promises?
Definitely criminal justice reform is at the center of it. She's really interested in addressing things like racial disparities in prosecutions and seeing fewer homeless people be prosecuted for things like sleeping on the streets. She wants to see every rape kit that comes through the city actually be tested. That's not currently happening. And she also wants more compassion for how immigrants are treated in this county.
Right. Is that something, though, that she could actually have any control over?
Yeah, it's not clear. The DA has a lot of discretion in which cases are actually prosecuted. She talks a lot about wanting to make distinctions about who goes into the criminal prosecution pipeline versus maybe who's diverted to other kinds of options other than going up for criminal trial. But beyond that, the DA doesn't necessarily control a lot of those decisions. It's not a policy-making position in that sense.
Right, right. And it doesn't control immigration policy, that office.
Yeah.
Federal purview. So it seems like she came out of nowhere. So, you know, both Jackie Lacey and George Gascon are known to Los Angeles. George Gascon actually worked in the LAPD. But does she have any endorsements?
Yeah, she definitely doesn't have as many as maybe Gascon or Lacey, but she's been backed by the Latino Coalition of LA, Patrice Cullors of Black Lives Matter, Knock LA, and she's also she's endorsed by a group of individuals who are representing victims of Ed Buck. She works very closely with the woman who is the head of that organization. And the Ed Buck prosecution, I think, is maybe something that she sees as a potential liability for Jackie Lacey.
That Jackie Lacey didn't pursue charges for a long time.
Yes.
And I don't know if there's any polling on this, but do you have any sense of the level of her support amongst voters?
I haven't seen any polling that's been made public. In terms of what we do know, we can look at her public campaign donation filings. And based on that, it doesn't seem like she has the kind of momentum that maybe a Gascon or certainly Lacey have. They're raising millions from various interests and spending a lot of money. She is more in the thousands category, mostly small dollar individual donors. And even when I interviewed her, she describes herself as an underdog. She understands that that's the role she's playing in this race. And I think she's just trying to really connect with what voters she can.
Well, as you indicated, she and George Gascon may be going after the same pool of voter, someone who wants a more progressive prosecutor. And so is there a danger that they would split that vote and then Jackie Lacey would be reelected?
Yes, I think that that is potentially something that progressive voters might want to think about.
Brittany Martin from LA Magazine. We've been talking about Rachel Rossi, candidate for LA County District Attorney. Brittany, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, why the renovation of LACMA may be in trouble after a major donor withdraws support. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, is losing a big donor of artwork. The Amundsen Foundation is LACMA's largest donor of European Old Master paintings and sculptures. They've donated about $130 million worth of art over the years. But now, no more. The president of the foundation, William Amundsen, says he fears that under the redesign of the museum, many of the pieces his foundation donated will end up in storage. Well, LACMA is just 6 weeks away from demolishing four buildings to make way for a $750 million new building by Swiss architect Peter Zumthor. Here to tell us more about all this is Frances Anderton, KCRW's design and architecture correspondent. Welcome.
Hello, Madeline.
And also Carolina Miranda, culture columnist at the LA Times. Hello.
Hello.
And full disclosure, KCRW is funded in part by the Amundsen Foundation. We'll get that out of the way. Carolina, how big a deal is this that the Amundsen Foundation is no longer going to buy Old Master, European Old Master paintings for LACMA?
I think on the scale of big deals, it probably registers at 11.
Wow.
This is a foundation that has been incredibly supportive of the museum over the course of the museum's modern life. It has donated works by Rembrandt, by Gian Lorenzo Bernini, by Jacques-Louis David, working with the museum in ways that has made LACMA a much more nimble collecting institution. So, for example, it can be very difficult for a museum. It can take very long for a museum to acquire a work. It has to go through an acquisitions committee. You have to secure budget. You have to get donors on board. And so what would happen with the Amundsen Foundation is a piece might come up for auction or a private dealer might be selling it. The Amundsen could acquire it very quickly and then donate it to LACMA. And so it means that LACMA has been able to essentially acquire a number of incredible European treasures through this relationship it had through the Amundsen Foundation.
And Francis, he is saying that, well, we're afraid that we will no longer have our artworks displayed on a permanent basis in this new redesign. Is that true?
Well, the fear is absolutely true. And definitely while the demolition and the construction happens, there's going to be a lot of artworks in storage. I think there always were a lot of artworks in storage. There's 120,000 artworks, I think, in the collection at LACMA. And they're not all on display at any one time. In fact, what Michael Govan said back in 2013 when he unveiled one of the iterations of the design for the building was at the time the museum was only ever able to show, I think, 2.3% of its collection. His argument is that actually in the bright new future for LACMA, he'll be able to show more of the collection because of the way the building's configured, and we can go into that in detail if you want. But also, and where there's such sort of anxiety, is this notion that the museum will cease to be an encyclopedic museum that puts its fantastic holdings like the European painters that we've just been talking about on permanent display. Michael Govan has a whole other theory of curation. What he wants to do is more, I think, take art, say, from these collections and put it into context. So, for example, in 2013, they did a really good show on Caravaggio and the painters of his time. It took some of the paintings donated by the Amundsen, mixed it up with other paintings that were loaned, and it gave the visitors a kind of different way to understand the paintings of that period. Govan sees that as the future. Critics say that's not what LACMA should be in the business of doing.
Right. And one of the ideas that Govan has put forth is that he wanted to focus, or he wants to focus more on Latin American art, right? Right. And that did not sit well with the Amundsen Foundation?
No. Michael Govan apparently suggested to the foundation that they shift attention to Latin America. But this again is where Michael Govan is, you know, he's a provocative character because he is a disruptor. And one of the ways in which he is being disruptive is by recognizing that Los Angeles is a very cosmopolitan city with people from all parts of the world. And we are very connected to Latin America and we're very connected to Asia. And he is cultivating a donor base there. And he is starting to do more and more shows that reflect that connection. And so the museum's shifting. How many shows on European 17th century paintings do Angelenos want to see? Maybe that's part of the calculus.
I guess also one of the fears that people have is that if the Amundsen, the Amundsen Foundation has been described as the DNA of LACMA, if they pull back and do no longer donate artwork, will that have a ripple effect and other donors will be scared to do that?
It could. Yeah. It could chill other donors who are like, hey, if these big wigs aren't purchasing art for the museum, why should we? And I think with the gallery plan and the way this museum is going to work still very unclear, you know, there is a reason for concern. While museums are rethinking their collections and the way they display their collections and the way they integrate, you know, works from other eras and other regions into those collections, you still, like, for example, I was just in New York and I went to the Museum of Modern Art, which has these recently reconfigured galleries. You know, you can still go to a gallery and you know where the Picassos are and you know where Van Gogh's Starry Night is. There is still this sense that there are going to be these, you know, these posts that guide you through those stories. And I think what is unclear at LACMA is like, okay, well, what are the posts going to be? How are they going to be arranged? What are some of the stories that are going to be told? We don't know.
We have no idea what's going to be in the new museum.
We have no idea what's going to be in the new museum.
We don't even know what the new museum is going to look like at this point, right? Because the funding's not there.
Here's the story on the funding, is that the museum says the price tag of the museum will be $650 million with $100 million of additional soft costs. So $650 to build and then $100 million to do everything from get the temporary buildings that are going to be necessary while the museum's under construction and all those other related costs. So far, they have raised $640 million, which includes a $300 million tax bond. And $125 million from the county that the county's just giving them. And that is if the museum stays exactly on budget. they have not begun demolition yet. And I was speaking to a philanthropy expert from Indiana University who has spent decades studying museum projects. Museum projects are wont to go over budget. Mm-hmm. In fact, they go on average 46% over budget. And I think the example of the Academy Museum right next door to LACMA is an example. They recently revealed that they are going $100 million over budget, which in their case is about 25% over their last estimate. And so currently...
So this could get up to $1 billion is what you're saying.
It could. It could if they don't manage costs. The other alternative is that they continue to value engineer the building to meet that $650 million dollar budget and continue to slice away at pieces of it in ways that will maybe compromise the architecture and the collection. And we've already seen that the Zumthor building that will be built is going to be smaller in terms of gallery square footage than the buildings it is replacing.
And it's losing some of what were going to be very lovely architectural features. It was going to be these so-called chapel-like gallery spaces that were going to have borrowed light, which is quite unusual for art galleries. In the value engineering and I think part of the environmental impact report process, those skylights disappeared. So now we wind up with galleries with artificial lighting. I'm sure Zumthor will do it very beautifully, but still, that's a serious aesthetic compromise.
Enter Save LACMA. So there are these
versions 1.0 and 2.0.
There are two organizations, very confusing, called Save LACMA, who are very critical of these funding proposals, of the design, of all of it. Can you succinctly describe what's happening with these protest groups?
Well, let's just say they, in a way, speak for several thousand people who are rather anxious at what's happening at LACMA. But we have two groups that are run by very, very, very passionate opponents of LACMA. One is called the Citizens Brigade. It is very loose-knit. It doesn't really have a tax status. It's essentially two people, Greg Golden, Joseph Giovannini, both of them architecture critics, both of them very frustrated at this project. They were behind, or at least Joseph Giovannini, although he won't acknowledge it publicly, they were behind an ad that appeared in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, which had the words Save LACMA in it, which set up some confusion because there's another group that is actually called Save LACMA. It is a formal nonprofit. It is made up, or rather helmed by, a couple who are well-known preservationists in Los Angeles, Richard Shave and Kim Cooper, and a fellow named Rob Holman, who has done a lot of work in fundraising, especially for arts institutions. They actually agree on the issues.
And what do they want, in essence?
They want to prevent the demolition that is pending, that is just around the corner, and they don't want to see this new building by Zumthor being built.
And they want a ballot measure.
The group Save LACMA, which is run by Rob Holman and involves Richard Shave and Kim Cooper, they want to put a ballot measure through that would limit the museum's ability and other county institutions' ability in the future to do these kinds of projects and the amount of financial commitment the county would have. There would also be a design review process. So, for example, as part of its own redo, the La Brea Tar Pits has had a very public process. There was a competition. Architects were invited. I think this is a process that the folks at Save LACMA would like to see. But I think both of them certainly are asking the question that it's like, before we tear these buildings down, like all that's happened so far has been asbestos abatement. Before we tear these down, it might be a good time to ask, is this project going to be worth it? Is it going to be too expensive? What's it going to do to our collections? And maybe this is a time for the County Board of Supervisors to put pause and say, hey, what are we doing here?
What's the likelihood of that happening?
It's hard to say what would happen. I think after demolition happens, it's going to be the train will have left the station and it'll be too late. So this is the moment to ask the question. Before we tear these down, what is it that this is going to achieve?
Carolina Miranda, culture columnist at the LA Times. Frances Anderton, KCRW's design and architecture correspondent. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Madeline.
And Michelle Loy is here now with some listener feedback. Hello.
Hi. We've been collecting questions and concerns all day about the coronavirus and what people want to know or what concerns they have about it. Something good says it concerns me. The United States put in charge a guy that thinks he can pray it away. This appears to be a reference to Mike Pence. Leandro Rossi, though, taking the more optimistic look, says just one more problem for President Trump to successfully solve. Hashtag MAGA. Art of Palms, though, says it concerns me that people will not be compelled to or motivated to adhere to quarantines due to the fact that a lot of people simply cannot afford to miss work. There are no incentives for people to take 6 days. We also got a lot of feedback on this bill that's percolating in the California legislature that would allow for the composting of bodies.
Oh, this is the story we did yesterday.
Yes, we did this yesterday. And generally, the KCRW crowd seems to be very much on board with this. Juan Chavez says, feed me to the wild animals. I'll become energy for them. Jesse Sanchez says they could toss my body in the dumpster for all I care. Maybe don't do that, Jesse. Whatever is cheaper, my family should use the money to go on vacation. Jennifer Knox says, think of the environmental footprint of graveyards, all the mowing and fertilizing. Toss me to a science lab. And Christian B. Martinez says, over my dead body, ... is where I would love to have one planted. I think he's talking about a tree, of course. Uh-huh. So yeah, a lot of love for body composting.
Okay, well, I guess it's related to, well, too soon.
We all end up compost anyway.
Yes, the worms win.
It's true.
Thank you, Michelle Aloy. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.